Welcome to the InfoWars Nightly News. It's Thursday, February 13th, 2014, and here are top stories.
Tonight, experts agree TSA scanners can be easily hacked. And Steve Pachinik exposes the spy state. That's next on the InfoWars Nightly News.
And when we take America back, you Nazis are going to prison!
And then there was one. We see now bankster-style mergers to create an information monopoly happening here in the U.S. We have, and globally, actually, as Kurt Nimmo points out, monopolizing the Internet, Comcast gobbles up Time Warner. Now, Comcast is the largest media and communications transnational corporation in the world. And it announced today that it will absorb Time Warner, the world's second largest media and entertainment conglomerate. We saw this thing happen with banks. Back in 1998, Bank of America and NCNB merged, and it looked like they were not going to get approval from the government because it was the merger of two of the largest banks. It is unprecedented in what it was going to create. When they got approval and they merged in 1998, it set off a wave of consolidation, and 10 years later, we had the failures that everybody knows, that the too-big-to-fail banks. They are now also too big to jail. Well, this is what is happening already in media companies. Already, we only had about five large media companies. Now, the two largest ones are going to consolidate. And what does that mean? Look at some of the companies that this involves. In Time Warner, AOL, that includes companies like CNN, Warner Brothers, Turner Broadcasting, New Line Cinema, Castle Rock Entertainment. Those are some of the content providers. We also see in Comcast, then, they have NBC, Universal Pictures, of course, MGM, United Artists. They nearly took over Disney a few years ago. Now, all those content providers are going to combine. That's going to have some impact on the free flow of information, you can bet. The mainstream media is going to get even more controlled, more monopolistic in its voice. But the other thing that's going to affect everybody is the control on the Internet, because they are the biggest controller of Internet service providers. We saw this with AT&T's broadband services were consumed into Comcast earlier. Now Time Warner, AOL, all of that is going to be combined together into one large controlled company. And that's going to have an impact on the cost that you pay for your Internet, as well as whether or not you see that getting any faster. There's not going to be any competition to push that along. But it also has concern for what it's going to mean for the information that goes out there. I mean, who needs CISPA if you've got a company who is so closely joined to Washington at the hip? It's well known, as Kurt Nimmo points out, that Comcast has, quote, a wealth of connections in Washington, that essentially they own the FCC. So that's something to be very concerned about, the prospect that we're going to have handpicked political apparatchiks deciding the fate of the Internet without bias, on a par with a government-sanctioned monopoly doing basically the same thing. That's from Kurt Nimmo's article. Now, Paul Joseph Watson has a story on InfoWars today. Homeland Security is now going to activate a national license plate recognition database. He says the Department of Homeland Security is going to activate a national license plate tracking system, and that's going to create a hot list of target vehicles so that they can scoop all this information up and look for what they call, quote, criminal aliens and absconders. Absconders, you know, those are people who, according to the dictionary, leave hurriedly in order to avoid detection. You're not going to be able to avoid detection from these people. They're going to keep it in their database. But, of course, why should we worry about them creating a hot list of target vehicles? Well, we've just seen the government kill a lot of innocent people just this last week with drone strikes that were based on metadata. And, of course, your license plate is metadata about you. And the troubling concern about that is not just that they're going to use this in a way to target political activists, but that they're also going to have mistakes with this. Can you imagine, with all the shootings that we've seen of the police, if you're on a hot target list and they pull you over something, they're going to be very trigger happy. Now, Paul Joseph Watson points out how this has worked in the UK and elsewhere. He says in the UK, political activists have been targeted by having their vehicles added to the hot list after just attending protests. One person was questioned under anti-terrorism laws after he traveled to take part in an anti-war demonstration. And critics of the system in Australia have condemned it as a Pandora's box for an abuse of power, mistakes, and illegal disclosure. Now, speaking of illegal disclosure, look at this article from Steve Watson. Security experts say that TSA scanners are wide open to hacking. Not only are they ineffective in terms of finding people, we've seen this pointed out by John Corbett when he demonstrated that if you put firearms on the side of you as you go through the scanners, they cannot detect those. And, of course, the TSA put a brave face on it, said, well, we're not going to respond to that. But then they started scanning like every fifth person or something. But, of course, they know that there is no threat. Their internal documents that were put out on the Internet on Pacer.gov after John Corbett sued them recently showed unredacted documents said that the Homeland Security, TSA, said that there was no threat at airports or airplanes. Yet, your information, your naked body scans, can easily be hacked by somebody into those systems. Now, the article says the supervisor's password screen could be subverted through just a simple SQL injection attack. But, of course, remember at the Super Bowl, we just saw recently that the Super Bowl security team, they took a picture of it with the CBS News crew. You could see their password was up on the screen, and that was a major breach of security. But what was also interesting was that their password was just the word welcome, although they got kind of tricky and they changed the E's to threes. I'm sure that would fool any hacker. And, of course, for 20 years, they used eight zeros as the nuclear football code. Now, in Illinois, electricity customers are going to be forced to buy smart meters. This is an article from the Weekly Standard. And first they point out that some people have been able to use the feedback from smart meters to save some money. But then they point out some interesting things that I hadn't seen before about smart meters. I said, one meticulous customer interviewed by the Times compared her usage for the month of July 2008 before the meter was installed to July 2009, found that her recorded usage had jumped from 474 kilowatt hours to 646 kilowatt hours, and her bill was $20 higher. Another one said that his bills were jumping even though he had installed a lot of new insulation. Are they getting errors in these readings? That's not something we've seen before, but what we have seen is the arrogance of the utility companies. What they came back and said was they were going to charge people $23 if they wanted per month, if they wanted to opt out of this. But then they said this, if customers make the decision to refuse a smart meter now and incur monthly charges associated with this choice, it should be with full knowledge that this refusal is simply deferring the inevitable. In other words, we are going to make you opt into the smart meter system, whether you like it or not. You can pay us $23 a month now if you want, but eventually you're going to be a part of that. And this is a government objective nationwide. And we understand that there are not only economic issues with this. When they charge you more for a time of day use, you don't really have a lot of control over when you're going to use that electricity any more than you can avoid rush hour traffic. You are not going to be able to avoid rush hour electricity charges. But there's also major privacy issues as well as health issues. But don't worry, they're going to force you to do that unless you get together and educate other people about the dangers and the issues involved in that. We can help you with that here at InfoWars. If you want to support our operation, one subscription can be shared with up to 10 people simultaneously. It's a great way to inform people. Well, that's it for our news portion of the program, but stay tuned right after the break. We're going to be talking to Dr. Steve Pachinik. He was someone who served over five administrations in the intelligence community at a very high level. He's going to talk about Vladimir Putin. He's going to talk about our Assistant Secretary of State who just made the F the EU statement. And he's going to talk about what's going on in the Ukraine. So stay tuned.
Introducing Pro One. All of your filtration in one system, portable, on the go. No more do you have two or three filters to just reduce sodium fluoride. You have a system that cuts out the sodium fluoride and up to 95% of hydrofluorosilicic acid. Advanced manufacturing technology combines silver impregnated white ceramic with new Aquametics advanced media for removal of fluoride and other heavy metals, all in one filter element. It is the only one that does it, and out of the gates, we have it discounted at 10% off with promo code WATER. This is the only system that in one unit helps reduce or remove pesticides, herbicides, chloramines, ammonia, and chlorine, hydrofluorosilicic acid, the most common form of fluoride not covered by other fluoride filter brands, and sodium hexafluorosilicate. Get your Pro Pure with a new Pro One filter today at InfoWarsStore.com or by calling 888-253-3139. facts are in. The studies are legion. Sodium fluoride and other toxic members of the fluoride family are devastating the health and cognitive ability of the American people. So why are the social engineers adding it to the water? Simple. Dumb down the host population that the parasitic technocracy is feeding on. We may not have been able to get fluoride out of the water supply yet, but we can help to get it out of our bodies. I am extremely excited to announce the exclusive InfoWars Life Fluoride Shield formulation, fusing six of the best documented ingredients from around the world to help the body remove not just toxic fluoride residues from the body, but a whole host of toxic substances. Let's take a stand against the globalists by blocking their poisons with Fluoride Shield. I use Fluoride Shield every day. Secure your Fluoride Shield and other pioneering formulations at InfoWarsLife.com today. Let's start cleansing our bodies now and support the InfoWar at the same time. That's InfoWarsLife.com.
Well, joining us tonight is Dr. Steve Pachinik. He's one of the world's most experienced international crisis negotiators and hostage negotiators. He's worked for over 20 years in this field for over five U.S. administrations. And, of course, he's worked with Tom Clancy on a couple of book series, the Tom Clancy Ops Center and NetForce book series. We want to talk to him tonight about his take on the Edward Snowden documents, what he believes is behind this as someone experienced in the intelligence community, as well as what he thinks is going on in the Ukraine. Welcome, Dr. Pachinik. What's foremost on your mind tonight?
Well, let me tell you what I think would be relevant to
okay.
both our answers. Number one is Snowden and what it really means in terms of intelligence and the amount of money that we're paying for it, which is $60 billion, and why Snowden is very similar to Ellsberg from the blog that I wrote. The second thing that we can talk about is, in fact, what constitutes the change in government, why we are in many ways in a military coup, and what's been happening all over the world, because in Thailand there's a coup, in Pakistan there's a coup, there's going to be a coup as well, and Egypt was a military coup. And why is America not having a military coup? Well, we do, because every legislative area is under military control. So what does that mean in light of the Snowden and in light of everything else that we're talking about? What I'm basically saying throughout all of this from my experience is that we have a whole phenomenon going on that has nothing to do with the national security or the legitimacy of the United States. And that's the military and the industrial complex playing around at the expense of the American public. So it's draining out $60 billion or $150 billion, depending on how much you count the appropriations, because now we're beginning to falter as a superpower. On the one hand, we have the superpower position, but we're not. The other thing that's very major for us, I would talk about two of them. One is the position in the Middle East, why we had to get out, and why today we had problems in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we didn't plan to have those consequences of war, the collateral damage. In other words, we went into two countries that we had no right to go in as a result of the incompetency of our presidency. So what I want to get at is that we have had for over 40 years, Republican or Democrats, really incompetent presidents who have not really understood of war, the nature of financial restitution, and the nature of what it is that we Americans need to have, which is prosperity, entrepreneurship, and, you know, a middle class. It has nothing to do with being Republican or Democrat. In turn, we have wasted our resources into the Middle East, and now we're shifting into a far more dangerous area. That's why Silicon Valley is secondary to me, although it may be primary to you, and that is China and Japan, where there really can be conflict over the Spratly Islands, over oil, and why we're shifting, and why, again, we don't necessarily have a basic interest. You know, it begins into the nature of, it really gets into the nature of what is America right now, and does it have relevancy to its political system? And the answer is no.
Yeah, you wrote in your blog, that's a very good point, you wrote in your blog that the relevance of the intelligence community is much like the military. It's relevant only to itself. You said our military has no need for the U.S., the U.S. has no need for the military, and it's the same way with the civilian military intelligence community.
And that's what they feel. They've been very clear to me and to others that since they went to war and we had no support for the military whatsoever, which we haven't. Now, remember, We haven't had support for our military since 1940s. Our war in Korea was a disaster. The Vietnam War was a disaster. The Iraq wars were a disaster. Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan. So what does the military say? Forget it. We'll just go to anywhere we want. We'll create wars, even with, you know, the president, who may not be CIA, but he is. And we'll just create drone attacks. And most people don't care.
That's right.
And most people aren't relevant. So what I'm saying is, yeah, we have a major disintegration of our institutions that is primarily represented by the military, the intelligence community, which constitutes a major part of our budget because we're in 732 bases in 234 countries. We don't have that many terrorists.
Yeah.
So we really have begun to start to disintegrate internally and externally. But we need, it's a moment of hope. Actually, the guys like you, the alternative media, has really preempted modern-day media or the mainstay media, where you have guys like Anderson Cooper, who we can talk about, who was really, you know, an intern at the CIA a couple of years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
But he's CIA. That's why he was fed this. This is not conspiracy. I mean, I've been in the business. I oversaw the CIA. I oversaw National Reconnaissance Organization. I oversaw all of them without belonging to them, but being their bosses, so to speak, because they have to report to a deputy assistant secretary of state. What that means is we are the ones who implement policy. We're the ones who create the initiatives that go overseas. In my particular case, I just dismissed the CIA for 30 years because they were incompetent. The only time they were competent was when Jimmy Carter fired over 4,000 CIA operatives. He was the first man only, and he was military.
Mm-hmm.
So not only did we have an inherent tension between the military and the civilians, but we'd had this ongoing war where they're becoming less and less reliable. And that's why the agencies have become more reliable, and they're drawing away our minds.
Let me ask you about the Snowden leaks. Now, he's been accused by the U.S. of being a Russian spy, a Chinese spy. I don't think too many people buy that line, but there are people who question whether this is a limited hangout or if he's a genuine whistleblower. You have a different take on this. Tell us what your take is on the Ed Snowden document.
Yeah, sure. You want me to tell you?
Go ahead.
Well, basically, let me go back to the history of Putin and Russia. Having been mainly involved in the takedown of the Soviet Union, I was sent to the RAND Corporation specifically to develop the architecture for the psychological warfare of taking down the Soviet Union. It wasn't done by the CIA. It wasn't done by Mikhail Gorbachev. I'm not the only one, but I was one of the few who could delineate the architecture because I was trained in both political science and in psychiatry, and I'd worked in the Soviet Union over 10 years during the 70s under Nixon and Ford and Reagan to take out political dissidents in psychiatric hospitals. So I had a very good idea where the weaknesses were. And I knew the KGB very well and the GRU. So when we took down the Soviet Union, we in fact made a mistake. We gave it to Yeltsin. Yeltsin was misread. I must admit I may have been part of that. I don't remember Yeltsin as well as I should have, but he ended up to be a drunk. But I do remember we reconstituted our attempts and put in Gorbachev. And Gorbachev, I thought, that's the one we were working with very strongly. We first had Gorbachev where we took down. Then Yeltsin came in. I'm sorry. We worked against Gorbachev. And Yeltsin came in, and Yeltsin turned out to be an alcoholic. And I was no longer in the government, but I had some input to say, look, this is not good. Russia has to reconstitute itself. We cannot have a sense of chaos in 122 different federations, which is really what Russia was. And instead, we had a guy named Putin. Didn't come up because he was a good guy, a bad guy. He's put up because the intelligence community, on a positive sense, brought in a guy who was very strong, who was trained by Marcus Wolf and by Andropov, guys that I worked with and knew.
So you're talking about Putin being put in. Would you say that the intelligence community in the U.S. had something to do with that?
I would say very strongly that they had. I think it was a very positive move. The intelligence community was very much a part, collectively, along with my initiatives at the RAND Corporation, others who were specialists in the Soviet Union, from the CIA and military intelligence, had the ability to take down the Soviet Union systematically without any war. And I think that's something that both Reagan and Bush Sr. in particular, and Baker, should be very proud of, and the Americans should be proud of, because this was an example where we had regime change without the use of military forces, without the fact that I know Charlie Wilson's war was emphasized as the pièce de résistance for the CIA, but the takedown of the Soviet Union was far more sophisticated. It involved national character. It involved economics. It involved the use and manipulation of the KGB and many other variables, which was not relevant to war, but to financial areas. In turn, what happened is when you bring down a regime, it takes some time, but at the same time, you have to think of what will follow the takedown of the regime. What you don't want is a power vacuum. In that power vacuum, you don't want a totalitarian leader to evolve. Having said that, what happened was the KGB entities became oligarchs and, in fact, became corrupt oligarchs. So every one of the institutions or factories in the United States that was run through the Central Committee became fractionated, hybridized, and cannibalized by the KGB. They took it over, and, in fact, there was no central control. Gorbachev, it turned out, the minute we put him in and we thought he was capable of handling a very, very multivariate country with many different elements and ethnic groups. And remember, the Soviet Union was consisted of 122 different countries and ethnicities. Gorbachev had failed. Then Yeltsin came in. I had left by that time, but I was still involved in the issue of, well, what will and who will manage the Soviet Union and Russia. The Russian Federation in and of itself is 11 time zones, so it's pretty big. Yeltsin turned out to be an alcoholic. Whether that was a misreading on behalf of our intelligence community or not, it was one of those elements that came out and had to be rectified very quickly. Within the ranks of the intelligence community in the Soviet Union or in Russia was a young man, ironically, trained first in East Germany. And who was he trained by? He was trained by someone who I had known and had encountered through a proxy, a man by the name of Marcus Wolf. Many of your listeners will know Marcus Wolf by the key player in the movie The Spy Who Came In from the Cold by Jean-Luc Godard. Mm-hmm. Marcus Wolf was a very special spy master, perhaps the greatest spy master of all, who ran over 100,000 East German Stasi operatives, S-T-A-S-S-I, operatives all over East Germany and the world. He had penetrated the BND or the West German intelligence and some of our own intelligence. He was so brilliant that by the time we were able to amalgamate or integrate East Germany with West Germany, we could not arrest Marcus Wolf because it would serve no purpose. Instead, he allowed his family to flee overseas, and we allowed him to become a cook. In that process, a very young man who worked for the East German intelligence eventually transitioned into the FSB or the KGB, and his name was Putin, Vladimir Putin. So he was identified very early on in our intelligence community as someone who was very pure Russian meaning not from Moscow, but from Leningrad, and whose grandfather, by the way, was a cook, not only for Tsar Alexander, but also for Stalin, and was very well entrenched in what we call the nationalist character of Russia. So he was trained not only by Marcus Wolf of East Germany, but by someone I had to work against, Andropov of the KGB, who was also a brilliant spy master. So eventually it was understood in the intelligence community that Putin would have to be the reigning ruler of the new Russian Federation, which we had taken down through the Soviet system, and he would have to accrue power by becoming totalitarian and really Russian in nature. And he was true to form. He basically consolidated the power. He consolidated all the oligarchs. He made sure that the oligarchs were in no way involved in political chicanery in Moscow. And in turn, they all received billions of dollars of corrupt political cronyism types of businesses, Gazprom, as well as construction companies, as well as all types of different industries that they were not attuned to or they were capable of running, but instead that was their political payoff on one condition, that these oligarchs never get involved in politics with Putin. Putin was true to form. And I think the success of the Sochi Olympics is the ultimate point of showing how a totalitarian leader, using his skills, using his background, is able to consolidate a huge country like Russia into a spectacular phenomenon in the midst of a terrorist scenario. So Putin has to be given credit, but at the same time, he arose because of the needs and concerns of the American and European intelligence branches. As a result, Putin really worked with in collaboration with the CIA and our military intelligence to allow us to transit through Russia into Afghanistan. And we paid him a lot of money to transit into Afghanistan. And that money, in turn, he allowed us to be able to put over spies or alleged spies like Snowden.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Pajenik. If it's in the U.S.'s interest to have one person to deal with in that area, to have a consolidated Russia, and Putin was the guy that they identified as doing that, give me your take on what's going on now in the Ukraine, where it appears that the EU and the U.S. are trying to undermine Putin. Is that your take on this, or?
Well, Ukraine has always had a history of what I call divided loyalties. Western Ukraine has always been part and parcel of Poland. After World War I, and historically, the Ukraine was never really part of its own national character. It had a certain cultural determinant, but never a geographical determinant. After World War I, Western Ukraine was part of Poland. It fought Poland and wanted to be part of Eastern Ukraine, which was also part of Russia. So you have the Eastern Ukraine, which is Russian, and the Western Ukraine. But the real issue in the Ukraine right now is not democracy versus the EU or Russia versus the United States. What it really is the Ukraine has no more money. And because of the corruption that occurred and because of our failure in the Orange Revolution about 10 years ago, and I don't fault us for that, it just turned out not to be as successful as we thought it was, meaning that we were able to bring a liberal democracy in there, but in turn Putin was able to reverse it. The real issue at hand is about $15 billion worth of debt that has to be serviced and that the EU is not willing to put up, neither is America, and that Putin said to the Ukrainian president, Yanukovych, look, I will collect all your debts, but in turn, I will give you cheaper oil, but you must maintain the integrity of my oil pipelines into Europe. That's the real issue at hand. What happened with Assistant Secretary Nuland, this woman who said, to Europe was nothing more than a very childish, impish attempt on an open phone to show the world that America was involved in really having strategy and in being involved in an aggressive anti-Russian campaign. The reality is quite different. We're not very effective.
So, in your opinion, her statement made on an open phone was really sending a message to the world.
Sending a message, but it was childish. It was inappropriate, and it was not consistent with our ability to maintain a diplomatic presence and at the same time manipulate the parties involved. She is not, I believe, Korea Foreign Service, although she states she's Korean Foreign Service. But her background, her actions belie that, and it seems to me that she may belong to another part of our government. I don't want to announce which part, but she had been Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, along with many other neocons, and her husband, Mr. Kagan, is a famous neocon. So I think she went off on her own as the Assistant Secretary for Europe and really belied any sense of strategy and tactics. You do not allow yourself to be compromised that way or even send a signal that way. It's gauche, it's childish, and the Russians will handle you with counterforce. So I felt that it was totally inappropriate. I think John Kerry, if he's an effective Secretary of State, and I'm not sure he is, he should dismiss her and fire her. But that's my personal opinion and professional.
I thought it was pretty amazing, the reaction from the White House chief spokesman, Jay Carney, says it's something about Russia. It says something about Russia that they would tap a telephone call. I mean, the insanity of that. It's like you can hear the entire world laughing that they would make a statement like that. We'll have the conclusion of that interview tomorrow night on the InfoWars Nightly News. It's a perspective from someone who spent decades in the intelligence community. Don't miss it. Join us at 7 Central, 8 p.m. Eastern.